Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Ayen Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, July 30th, 2018. One of the former detainees says his group has had a change of heart and will sign the power-sharing deal with their issues to be taken up later.
The most important is that all people are going to sign, but with reservations which are going to be bracketed.
And a top government official says the government will not budge on power-sharing issues at the local level.
We objected, of course, to taking it to PAYAM level because PAYAMs are usually run by administrators, civil servants. And these positions which are being shared are political positions.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The former detainees who refused to sign the power-sharing deal reached between the government and some opposition groups last week due to some provisions they did not like now say they will sign the deal. Former detainee Deng Alor says his group told Sudanese mediators it will sign initial documents before a final peace agreement is signed next month. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
The former detainees and the South Sudan Opposition Alliance declined to initial the power-sharing deal last week because of their opposition to retaining several newly created states and other provisions in the Khartoum Agreement. Alor says his group believes the proposed Independent Boundaries Commission won't be able to consult with ordinary South Sudanese at the grassroots level to gather their views regarding the number of states within the 8-month pre-interim period. But Alor says the former detainees have agreed to sign the deal to enable the talks to move forward for the sake of peace in the country and address the outstanding issues later.
The mediation will guide us on the way when we could sit as parties with the help of mediation so that we resolve the issues which have been bracketed. The most important is that all people are going to sign, but with reservations which are going to be bracketed.
Alor says the Sudanese mediators have assured the opposition that some of the outstanding issues could be bracketed and move forward to the next round of talks. He says his group wants to make sure the South Sudanese people are aware of the concerns of the former detainees, including their doubts over the credibility of the proposed referendum to resolve the disagreement over the numbers of states.
Within the 5 months, you cannot conduct a referendum. Because who is going to be responsible for that referendum? It is the current government. The rest will not be there. So we are saying, no, this is not possible. So we are going to, maybe, if we don't agree, we will bracket it and go ahead.
He says the former detainees have also shared their concerns over the power sharing at the state level with the mediators, which he says should be inclusive.
The government is talking about 65% for them and 35% for the opposition. We are saying no, it should be 55 for the government and 45 for the opposition. And the opposition will now divide the 45% among themselves.
Alor says, despite their opposition to parts of the deal, his group remains committed to restoring peace across the country in order to end the suffering of citizens. He's urging the South Sudanese to monitor implementation of a revitalized peace agreement.
I hope the people of South Sudan this time put a lot of pressure on all of us, so that we implement the agreement and so that we avoid a return to violence and so that we focus on issues of resettlement, issues of rehabilitation, and then later, of course, we move to the development of our country.
Repeated calls and text messages to South Sudan Opposition Alliance spokesperson Kwajel Lasso for comment on this story went unanswered. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
A South Sudan government delegation at the talks in Khartoum has returned to Juba to consult on outstanding issues again. Information Minister Michael McQuay says the delegation will talk to President Salva Kiir and other top officials about power-sharing ratios at the state and county level. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
The delegation arrived back in Juba this morning and is expected to return to Khartoum before the end of the week to sign a final peace agreement in Khartoum. Government spokesman Michael Makwe told reporters at Juba International Airport the government objects certain proposals from opposition groups like sharing power at the county and Payam levels.
The power sharing agreement, which we are revitalizing now, had limited the role of the opposition to the state level. But this time, and according to the new draft, they are supposed to go up to the Payam level. And we objected, of course, to taking it to the Payam level because Payams are usually run by administrators, civil servants. And these positions which are being shared are political positions. And we also disagree on the percentages of power sharing at the state level.
The power sharing deal signed last week between the government and some opposition parties gives the opposition 27% representation in each of the states of South Sudan. Makwe says his delegation will also talk to President Kiir and other top officials about how to reform South Sudan's judiciary branch of government.
One is the formation or the composition of the NCAC, National Constitutional Amendment Committee. This is the body which is supposed to review the laws and incorporate the agreement into the constitution. We have not agreed on the composition. This is easy. We will easily agree. The other point is on the composition of the... We agreed also that the judiciary should be reformed, but we have not agreed on the composition of the committee that will make the reform the judiciary.
The South Sudan Opposition Alliance and the former detainees refused to sign the deal last week because of several provisions they disagreed with in the document. But now former detainee Deng Alor says his group will sign the deal and work out their disagreements with the government later. Makwe says whether or not other opposition groups eventually sign the deal, the government will implement it with the SPLA/M in opposition and other parties that have already signed on.
If they don't sign, we will continue to implement the agreement without anybody, without them.
Makwe says the Kiir administration is satisfied with the way Sudan is mediating the talks and believes Sudan understands the dynamics of the South Sudanese conflict better than most countries in the region.
In the past, when we go to Addis or we go anywhere else, the people who come in are people who do not have any background about our problem, and they don't know who is who. But when we went to Khartoum, Khartoum knows us one by one, by name. They know all the organizations. They know all the rebel groups that are there. All these rebel groups, most of them were based in Khartoum.
And Makwe says if Khartoum mediators tell rebel groups not to repeat their mistakes of the past, they will listen. Once a final peace deal is signed, Makwe says, the government will spend as much money as it can get to implement it. South Sudan is facing an economic crisis characterized in part by high inflation and a foreign currency shortage, according to the World Bank and independent observers. But Makwe says the government is capable of getting the finances of the country running again under an expanded, inclusive transitional government of national unity. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
South Sudan National Security Service operatives are detaining political rights activist Peter Biar Ajak after he was arrested over the weekend. A family member and a lawyer say it's unclear why he was arrested, but a top government official says security agents must have a good reason for detaining the activist. Waki Simon Mudu has this report for VOA from Juba.
Peter Biar Ajak's sister tells South Sudan in Focus security agents picked up her brother at Juba International Airport on Saturday morning as he was about to travel to Awil to participate in today's Martyrs' Day celebrations organized by youth in Awil State. Alekir Ajaka Deng says family members have not been allowed to see Biar, who is being held at the National Security Service headquarters in Juba, commonly known as Blue House. Ajak says she is calling on the government to release her brother.
If the government could listen to us, please release my brother. That's the only message you can tell him, to release him and set him free.
Ajak says her brother is innocent and not a threat to anyone, so her family does not understand why he was arrested. She says he is just like any other South Sudanese citizen. BR founded a number of local organizations, including the Red Army Foundation and South Sudan Young Leaders Forum, and was recently featured in several interviews with the international media, in which he calls the peace talks in Khartoum unrealistic in the mediator's bid to restore peace and stability across South Sudan. BR's arrest has sparked wider condemnation on social media platforms, with many people demanding that the government either release him immediately or charge him with a specific offense in a court of law. Philip Sanyangong, a human rights activist working with the Advocates Without Borders, confirms BR is being detained by the National Security Service. Gong says he tried to see BR at Blue House today, but says not only did officials refuse to let him meet with BR, but they refused to explain why the activist is being detained. He notes BR has been detained for more than 24 hours, but has not been allowed to make a court appearance.
I also want to know if someone has been arrested, should be arrested and charged and produced in court. Arrest can just happen, can be effected without the proper cause. The procedures that are known, that if you arrest someone, there should be a reason for arresting that person. But then exhaustion of that thing, exhausted through the rightful means. So arresting Peter BR is one thing, but then all the procedures of him being availed to his lawyers, him being availed to his family members, are things that we expect. And we want the government to look into this thing and have this person produced if there's a case against BR.
Information Minister Michael Makwe says, although he does not know the circumstances surrounding his arrest, security operatives must have a good reason to detain BR.
Anybody who is usually arrested is arrested for a reason. And I don't know why he was arrested. I don't even know about his arrest. I've learned it now from you. So I have no answer to your question.
The South Sudan Security Act gives the national security officials sweeping powers to arrest, detain, search and charge suspects without a warrant and a due legal process, a law which activists say must be rewritten. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
South Sudanese activists are reacting angrily over the arrest of the chairman of the South Sudan Young Leaders Forum. Peter Biara Jock was reportedly picked up at Juba International Airport by national security officers while traveling to a Awil state on Friday. John Penn is a South Sudanese activist who escaped from Juba after the 2013 violence. He says the arrest of Biar has emboldened civil society activists to be vocal.
I have seen arrests. I have seen killings of my colleagues. I was in Juba when Isaiah Abraham was shot at. I've heard about Moi Peter. Dong Sewell was taken from here. I was here. This does not sway us in any way. In fact, I have been actually angered to do more, to talk about BR, to talk about myself, to talk about my other people who are being trampled upon, whose rights are being actually put under the carpet by the regime. So this should go to the government and those who are handling activists and citizens on behalf of the government in an attempt to silence them, that they make the government lose twice. Every time you see an activist is shut down or is killed or is intimidated, the government loses twice in terms of publicity, diplomacy, and the following from the citizens. Because we speak for the citizens. I speak for my mother, for anybody who does not speak.
John Payne, yeah. The arrest of Pierre Jack is sending a message to people who are vocal like you. What is your reaction about this arrest?
The arrest of Peter Biar has reactivated the call for the repeal of the security, National Security Act, that gives the National Security goons to arrest, search, detain, charge, and do anything at will to the South Sudanese citizens. They have relegated the police to a lower level of being guards, security guards to the politicians and all this. So my reaction to this is not that I am scared. I'm not scared in any way. They can come for me or for anybody. That is not the end of the world. That is not the end of the citizens' cry. We will continue. Anybody can come up after I am taken or BR is taken. Actually, the arrest of any citizen, as I told you before, makes the government lose its twice. Like, the whole world is mobilized against the government, the whole country, the citizens that have no voice begin to sympathize with those voices that are being trampled upon. So I'm not scared in any way. I'm encouraged. I have to fight on. Peter Biya is arrested today, whoever will be arrested tomorrow, but we will continue telling Salva Kiir and his regime that you are leading us the wrong way. Please listen to our voices and we jointly lead our country the right way. This is the right way where John Gerang and the rest died for, which is the day today. I'm not happy with the way they have commemorated the Martyrs' Day with the arrest of the son of a liberator of South Sudanese people.
And we are hearing from Juba that the national security picked Peter Biya because of some of his recent comments to local and international media. You were a panel on one of the talk show on Kenyan television. What did Peter say that angered the government?
It's not a particular statement that I could single out. My reaction, Peter's reaction, or anybody's reaction to Khartoum agreement is the normal reaction any citizen would do. Peter was calling for Riek Machar and Salva Kiir not to sign that agreement. He, at times, not on the same show, but on other shows, he has been even going ahead and saying Salva Kiir and Riek Machar should give way to the citizens of South Sudan. That was his one of his statements. Though on that show he did not mention it, but he was critical of the Khartoum agreement, especially the declaration that first recognized the three regions as a resort to 10 states or 32 states. There are comments that he has been making, and those are noble comments of a citizen. He is not going there with the army to topple the government or whatever. Whatever you say against somebody when you are in your hiding or in your house does not mean that person is crumbling or is being overthrown.
That's John Penn, a South Sudanese activist in exile, speaking from Nairobi with my colleague John Tanza. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Zimbabweans are heading to the polls after nearly four decades of rule under Robert Mugabe. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what do you think is the most important human right?
To me, the most important human right is for everyone to be given a fair trial, that is, those that are in court, so that they don't get punished for something that they did not commit.
The most important human right is the right to live, because God is the maker of human beings. So he has given you that opportunity. So you should have the freedom to move anywhere you want to. There's no restriction.
The freedom of speech that I think is when I have something which is burning within me, I have the right to tell you, do you think you are doing is wrong? When it's right, I will tell you, do you think is right? And when you stop me from saying that, everything will get worse because you have neglected my right.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Zimbabweans are voting today in an election many hope will turn around the nation's shattered economy after 38 years of iron-fisted rule under former leader Robert Mugabe. The two main presidential rivals voted today, each saying they're confident of victory. This election is effectively a race between President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who took over after Mugabe's resignation in November, and opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. Yesterday, Mugabe lashed out at the ZANU-PF party, accusing it of deposing him in a coup. He hinted heavily he would vote for Chamisa. A frail-looking Mugabe was greeted by a welcoming crowd at his polling station in Highfield suburb. Reporter Anita Powell was there and describes the atmosphere to VOA's Kim Lewis.
The mood was electric when Robert Mugabe showed up to vote this afternoon at his traditional polling station in Harare. The crowd welcomed him, crying out his name, but also crying out the name of the opposition challenger, Nelson Chamisa. The way that they speak about him is they call him Chiza, Chiza, Chiza. They yelled out Chiza and also Mugabe's nickname. So he got an ecstatic reception. He went in to vote. He took an awful long time to vote. In his little cardboard box, he was assisted by his daughter, Bona, and his wife, Grace. Did not speak to the media on his way out. It was quite an event, and the people there were very happy to see him.
Yesterday, he said that he would not give ZANU-PF his support. So, as I guess you just mentioned, he didn't give any indication of who he would be voting for.
I asked him directly, Mr. Mugabe, who did you vote for? Who are you going to vote for? And he did not answer my question. But yes, as you say, yesterday he indicated that he would not vote for the ZANU-PF ruling party and indicated that he might likely vote for opposition leader Nelson Chamisa.
And how does Nelson Chamisa feel about this election?
Nelson Chamisa Lisa, I saw earlier today at his polling station in Harare, and he feels confident. He says this is more or less a done deal. Victory is assured for the opposition. He feels clearly very confident. When asked by another journalist about President Mnangagwa's angry response to Mugabe's quasi-endorsement, he said, "I don't want to talk about that." So he is maybe distancing himself a little bit from Mugabe, but he seems confident to victory.
What about the other challengers? How are they feeling about this election?
Well, Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current president, voted out of town about 3 hours out of Harare along with his wife this morning, and he seemed calm and confident. Again, all of the presidential challengers seem pretty pumped up and assured of victory, or at least they believe in themselves and their ability to win. The two main rivals both believe that they've got this in the bag.
Overall, how is voting going, and are there any issues at this point?
So it's a little early in the day. We're right around midday right now. So far, we haven't heard of any major issues, especially not in Harare, which, of course, being the capital, is very well watched and very saturated with media. That's an important consideration. But so far, we haven't heard of any major problems with the vote. A lot of the concerns really centered more on the run-up to the poll, the voters' roll, the ink, which we're now seeing some social media posts saying that the ink can be very easily removed. I'm speaking of the ink that you put on your finger after you vote to make sure you don't vote again. There are little things like that. But so far, we haven't heard anything, definitely not in the capital, of any major problems. There are little bits and bobs from the outer parts of the country, but those are very hard to verify. We're not there. And so I believe we're going to have to wait a little bit before we really have a clear picture.
And what are Zimbabweans saying they want out of this election?
So every Zimbabwean I've spoken to says at the end of the day, they want jobs. They want the economy to improve. The second most quoted thing is they want change, which indicates that they are not inclined to vote for ZANU-PF, the ruling party, which has been in power for more than 38 years.
That's reporter Anita Powell speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from Harare. Malians went to the polls yesterday in what's widely expected to be the first round of Mali's presidential elections. The atmosphere was calm in the capital, but instances of violence were reported in other parts of Mali. Bram Postumus has this report for VOA from Bamako.
Voting was slow in the Malian capital Bamako on Sunday. At 8 a.m., there were very few people at the voting stations, in keeping with the low rate of voter card collection by the Bamako electorate. And some were even less lucky. I'm Eli Togo. I never got my voter card. I went to look for it, but it wasn't available. That's a shame, because I would have loved to cast my vote for my candidate. But let the best win and rule with love for our country in his heart. There were other reasons why Malians could not vote. By early Sunday afternoon, there were reports of attacks in the north and the central regions of the country. Timbuktu, Kidal and Mopti reported violent incidents that prevented some people from casting their votes. At least 10 incidents of violence at polling stations and against election officials had been reported by mid-afternoon. These are the areas that have presidential candidate Sheikh Modibo Jara worried,
but when
and
you get
not
to Mopti,
just because of the violence. These
million,
are the two regions where roughly only half of the residents have
vote.
Been
that
receiving their voting cards.
You know, provided somebody put their hands on those bulletins on behalf of those people, you know, that can bias, you agree with me, heavily the outcome of this election.
On Saturday, the government and the opposition, in the presence of international observers, reached what they called a consensus on the elimination of fictitious voters and the parallel register, which the opposition claims tilted the election in the government's favour by a whopping 1.2 million possible votes. Jara and his opposition colleagues now hope the contest will be more transparent. Mali's vote is crucial for the international community led by France and the United States, which is using the country as a cornerstone for its fight against terrorist groups in the region. Neighbours such as Burkina Faso, Mauritania and Niger, which are also affected by Mali's instabilities as they have hosted tens of thousands of refugees since the country's conflict began in 2012, are also keenly watching the outcome. Malians consider it their civic duty to vote but have little confidence in the current system changing. Some analysts have been predicting an upset, and in terms of names, this means that either President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita or his main challenger, Soumaila Cissé, would not win more than 50% of the vote, leading to a second vote on August 12th.
Results of Sunday's vote may be known by Wednesday, although a final result is not expected until Friday. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Bamako.
Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is wrapping up his first visit to the Ethiopian community in the U.S. with a stop in Minnesota. The diaspora gave Ahmed a warm welcome in three American cities. The prime minister has introduced major political, economic, and diplomatic initiatives in his first 100 days in office. Dr. Peter Pham, vice president of the Atlantic Council, tells VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi those reforms are important.
I think the diaspora, in many respects, not just for Ethiopia, but really almost every African country, represent an enormous pool of human capital, people who are talented, ambitious, energetic, and in some cases also because of the success they've had, also with the means to help development even financially in their home country. So I think it's an important outreach. In the case of the Ethiopian diaspora, many of which have been in the past alienated from the government in their home country, the fact that he's receiving such a rapturous welcome from them, I think, is particularly significant. Many of these people had backed the opposition over the years, and that they're welcoming him and rallying behind him is extraordinary. I had the opportunity to be with Prime Minister Abe when he met with some of the leaders of the diaspora, and the enthusiasm that they showed for him was really stunning and heartwarming.
In his first 100 days in office, Ethiopian Prime Minister has closed prisons, released political prisoners, and opened up the political space. How would such reforms impact stability and development in Ethiopia?
Well, I think almost everything he's done, I think, contributes to the long-term development and sustainable stability of the country over the long term. In the short term, obviously, when you have such a frenetic pace of change, so many momentous reforms, that's going to unsettle things. So there's inevitably a bit of turbulence, some of it from resistance, some of it from energies long pent up. So I think the important thing, I think, to remember, and this is both for the international community and for Ethiopians, is to manage expectations. He's bringing a lot of change. He's clearly brought a new climate within the country and into the region, but the man is also only human, and one can only do so much, and one is constrained also by basic laws of economics and geopolitics, so the expectations need to be managed.
Mr. Ahmed led a historic deal to end two decades of Cold War with Eritrea, improved relations with Sudan, and has been trying to ease tensions with Egypt over the Renaissance Dam. What's your take on that?
I think all are important. Ethiopia is a regional power in East Africa. More than 90 million people, the huge potential to solve much of the region's energy deficit through its building of the dam, but it needs to be done in a way that doesn't also negatively impact other countries, including Egypt. And the fact that he's engaging with these countries is good for the security and stability of the region, but it's also good for Ethiopia, not only politically, but economically. Certainly better relations with Eritrea will increase not only commerce, but give Ethiopia alternative access to the sea, which will also help the Ethiopian economy.
That's Dr. Peter Pham, Vice President of the Atlantic Council, speaking to VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Insane by Maurice Kiria.
Time and time and again, I wake up screaming your name. Nothing in my world feels the same ever since you took your love away. You're making me go insane. 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 eternity. And I can't wait to see your face.
We've been listening to Maurice Kiria with the song Insane. I'm Ayen Deng-Bior in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
You're making me go insane. You're making me go insane.